Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome to this holiday edition of News and Views. I'm your host, Rob Schofield. This week, we take a look back at some of our favorite interviews of 2019, starting with Sherry Beasley, who became North Carolina's first ever black female Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in February. It was our honor to sit down with Beasley to discuss the School Justice Partnership, Second Chance legislation, and the impact of rising court fines and fees on low-income North Carolinians. Chief Justice Beasley, welcome to News and Views. It's so delightful to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Rob. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been in this job now as the Chief Justice of our state for the last 6 months.
That's correct.
Do you have any initial impressions of what it's been like?
Well, it has been quite a transition. It's been a wonderful one. I have two roles now as the Chief Justice. I lead the court, mostly administratively. Right. We hear the same cases and sit on those cases together. And then I lead the branch of government. So there are nearly 6,500 people who make up the judicial branch, elected judges, elected DAs, clerks of court, and a whole host of folks in our 102 courthouses across the state of North Carolina.
Gosh.
So it's been wonderful. We've had a really great transition, and it's been great working with judges and folks thinking about projects and programs they'd like to start and continue in their respective judicial districts. And so it's been pretty awesome.
That's something probably that the general public is not aware of. They don't realize that the chief has, they think of the Chief Justice as being the first among equals, perhaps on the court itself. But the idea that you're also this administrator of supervising hundreds, if not thousands of people, how do you find time to do that? Has it not been overwhelming?
Well, it really hasn't been overwhelming. I have Director McKinley Wooten, who really manages the day-to-day. Really, most of my responsibilities have been just traveling around the state to make sure that things are as folks would have them to be. And in so many ways, I mean, judges and DAs and other folks are doing yeoman or yo people's jobs with fewer resources. And so in every way that I can try to get more resources for them, I'm trying to do that.
So no days where you wake up and say, oh my gosh, what have I gotten myself into?
Never. No, I feel truly blessed.
That's great. One of the things that you've been touting recently, and there was an event in Greensboro a while back, is this School Justice Partnerships program. And it's talking about the whole issue of how we're dealing with school discipline and whether we're bringing it into the justice system. Talk to us a little bit about what that's all about.
Last year, there were 11,000 young people who were referred to the juvenile justice system from the schools. And what we've realized is that there are a host of reasons that young people can find themselves on the other side of the law, if you will. And what we do know is that children are going to be more successful when they are in the classroom and not the courtroom. And so the partnerships have really been very fruitful, where law enforcement and educators and judges and DAs and community people and county commissioners and public health officials have come together to really galvanize around the success of children. And so the first partnership happened in New Hanover County about a year and a half ago. And in that very short period of time, they've seen the decrease in referrals from the schools to the juvenile justice system of about 60%. So we know it works. And I'll tell you, one of the most fascinating things about the partnership is it certainly makes sense that we would have law enforcement officers in our schools. But what those men and women have found is that not only are they there to serve and protect, if you will, but also to serve as mentors for young people. And just building those relationships with young people and figuring out why it is that young people are finding themselves in trouble. When children are hungry, and in North Carolina, 1 in 5 children is hungry, that's an access to justice issue. When there's a caretaker with a long-term illness, I mean, children don't have the language to articulate those kinds of issues in their home life. And so just establishing relationships in great part and really having us be more astute around the kinds of issues that may plague children, I think in very short term has really caused a real turnaround in New Hanover County. So we have about 38 other counties that have signed on.
38 counties.
And so we're really excited about progress across the state.
It's such an important issue. My wife was a special ed teacher in the Wake County schools for a long time and dealt with kids in just that situation who came to school hungry, who came to school from broken homes where, you know, the child really didn't have that mentor at home quite often. And so whatever we can do to help save those kids from the criminal justice
Absolutely.
System, it seems like it makes the most sense. Are there some broader issues? You're administering this huge branch of government now. Are there some other key issues that you see as top priorities?
Funding is always a prevailing issue. Actually, the funding for the judicial branch of government is roughly 2% of the entire budget for the state of North Carolina. And so we're always looking for more resources. We have just signed a contract to implement the Integrated Court Management System, which will completely revolutionize the way we do business in our courts in North Carolina. In a global economy, it makes sense that one should be able to be outside of North Carolina physically, but to do business easily in North Carolina. And we have DOS systems here in all of our courthouses, in all 102. And so those systems have no way of really communicating intra-court systems. So, you know, our clerks who are working really hard but not very efficiently and having to enter the same kinds of data in different parts of those systems 3 and 4 different times. And so a lawyer or a member of the public would be able to access information about a particular case from their own electronic devices. And so that's, in my mind, is access to justice. In many of the rural counties across the state, the courthouse is 20 miles away from a person's home. And so we want to try to break down as many of those barriers to access as possible. And I think the e-courts, as we fondly call it, will wonderfully help us to do that.
What about the issue of, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this growing debate over court fines and fees and how we have continued to ratchet up fines and fees. And in many ways, for many people of low income, in effect, sometimes we're even criminalizing poverty. There are people simply who can't pay their court fines and fees, maybe for a minor traffic offense. They lose their driver's license. They get tangled up in a system, mostly just because they don't have the money. Any thoughts on that issue?
We are having those very critical conversations with judges and DAs and clerks and other folks across the state. And I hear much of that concern from a whole lot of folks who are very concerned that if they impose a $200 fine plus the court costs, and you're talking roughly $500, I mean, for a lot of folks, that is practically impossible. That's true. And when you think about their housing needs and other financial obligations. And the other piece of that is, in so many instances, there are about 9 or 10 million people who live in North Carolina, and roughly 1 million people are driving with a revoked license. And we're not talking about driver's license revocation for serious offenses. We're talking about mostly minor traffic offenses. So we're not talking about driving while impaired. You know, when we think about the fact that if one can't pay a $500 or $200 fine imposed initially, and if they can't pay it within the first 3 months, we know the likelihood of them paying it thereafter is slim to none. And so we're finding that in many cases, people's driver's licenses are revoked for 15, 16, and 17 years. Well, talk about a barrier. It's hard to hold down a job. I think we also don't think about the collateral consequences. If you don't have a driver's license, it's hard to get a barber license or a beautician's license or to rent a place to live. So a driver's license is really critical. What we have found in a lot of counties across the state, and I think it's really wonderful that we're having really great conversations about the impact of this on people who are working really hard. We're talking about people who are really making an effort to work, to support their families, to be viable in the community. And so we have programs across the state where DAs and judges are coming together. And once they see that people are really trying, going through those driver's license records and seeing where they can offer some relief and so that people can have their licenses restored. One of the other things that we're doing in combination with that is we've started faith and justice initiatives around the state. And one of the things that places of worship are so excited about is, you know, older congregations are dwindling. So they are looking for projects which align with the missions of their worship. And then so those places also tend to be in communities where there's the greatest need. And so their partnerships are around judges and DAs actually going to those places of worship and hosting driver's license restoration clinics as well as expungement clinics.
Wow.
And so there are a lot of folks in North Carolina who are eligible for expungement but don't even know it. And it is quite a complicated process. And so we're trying to just really provide access and make those kinds of things easier. And so we have lots of lawyers who are volunteering to help DAs because it's quite an arduous process to go through driver's, and they're difficult to read as well.
Yeah.
And so we certainly don't want to make more work for folks who are already working really hard, but just providing opportunities for folks to get on their feet and be able to go on and work and do great things.
We know there's legislation actually, as we talk pending at the General Assembly, the so-called Second Chance Act that hopes to expedite this process and make it even more possible for people to have a second chance to pay their debt. You're in this interesting position where, of course, you're the Chief Justice of our state, but do you have a role in the legislative process? Are you asked at ever to sort of speak out on these kinds of issues, this kind of legislation? Can you play a role in that?
Well, I think it's important that I have a relationship with members of the legislature and certainly with the leadership, and that they understand what the needs are of the judicial branch. I'm certainly hopeful for that piece of legislation. I think it's great legislation, which has bipartisan support. And really, not just for the state of North Carolina, but their national groups who are vested in really understanding and appreciating what a game changer that will be. I mean, the things that we take for granted in life will make the difference in so many other people's lives. And so I'm hopeful for that legislation. I hope it'll pass, and I trust that it will. And so we're really very excited about that.
That's right. It's one of the rare instances in these divided times where progressives and conservatives seem to have kind of come together. So we'll take that as a very hopeful sign. Here's an issue I wonder if you have any thoughts about or even feel comfortable talking about, which is the debate that's been taking place over how we select judges in our state. We've had some people say, well, maybe we shouldn't elect judges anymore. We should go to a quote-unquote merit selection system. Or maybe the legislature should appoint judges. What do you think about that, or where we are right now?
I have great thoughts about that and speak nationally about it. You know, I think that the benefit of appointment is helpful when one is the one who's chosen. And I can say that as one who has been a beneficiary of the appointment system and one who it worked against as well. So there was a time when I sought appointment for the Court of Appeals, was not appointed, and just ran outright. What I have found, and I've done the research because I think it's important to really know what's happening across the country, is for places where there is merit selection or some kind of retention election, there doesn't seem to be really as much diversity as in states where there are just outright elections. But the fear, however, with outright elections, because here's the conundrum, is that these elections are not just state elections anymore. There is national outside money being poured into state judicial elections across the country. And while I talked about the benefit of general elections that offers greater diversity, it's usually women and minorities who are targeted by dark money. And that's problematic. It's problematic when we think about what fairness and integrity really ought to look like for our courts. And also, diversity is important, and really our courts ought to look like North Carolina.
We really appreciate you coming by, and thank you so much for your service to our state, and wish you all the best in your service as Chief Justice of our state, and look forward perhaps to doing this again sometime.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
Coming up next, we'll hear from Durham County District Attorney Satana DeBerry. Don't go away.